Hello and welcome to another expert this week. And today we have Wayne, and he's going to be talking to us about our options regarding pension funds and also how he sits in that journey. But just as a reminder, this podcast is brought to you by the Academy World, and we support SMEs at any stage of the business, and we help pair you up with the experts we believe is best for you. So that's enough about me. So Wayne, thank you very much for joining us today. So what do you do? What's your expertise, Wayne?
Thank you, Andrew. My expertise is, I believe, I find pretty much like you, the right company fit for the individual company that needs my services. So I effectively have agencies in four different areas. The latest one is accountancy, and we're going from the most recent to the oldest. The next two are two different law firms. One is a specialist boutique tax law firm. The other is a more commercial law firm based in Bedfordshire. And then finally, financial advice, which, having been a qualified financial advisor, I find my skill set is perhaps better suited to finding and working with one specific firm for a particular person, and all the time that advice is what I consider to be the best of breed, I stick with them, and if it's not, then I will move on to another financial advisor. So the fact that I do the work required to get the end client the best set of advice.
Okay, so to ask lay people, I understand what a pension fund is. I understand what an advisor is, but you at the moment are on either of those. We're going to define as an introducer. So, well, what's the differences? What's going on there?
So, as an introducer, whilst I have been a financial advisor for a couple of firms, as I said, I think my skill set is better effectively managing a meeting between the end client and the financial advisors that I've chosen to use for them. There's no extra cost for the end user client. Very often I find that financial advisors tend to kind of try, I don't know if it's the fact that they can't perhaps see the wood for the trees, but they go into too much detail, perhaps because they feel they've got to justify what they do. And I think very, very often my role is trying to translate into everyday language what the expert's advice and the there are so many abbreviations used in financial advice that sometimes I despair when I'm at a meeting that I have to try to get the financial advisor to slow down and explain what LTA is, MPAA. And I think it's the problem with being involved in one particular world and not realizing that not everybody knows what these abbreviations are. So I think certainly for financial advice, that's my role, sitting in on the meeting, having made the introduction, and ensuring that the financial advisor isn't just talking with some technical gobbledygook that confuses everybody.
Sure. Okay, so I think you worded it perfectly. So you're a translator for the clients, but also with your expertise from past, you are sort of got a sort of a looking down at what's going on to think, actually, is this in your personal opinion rather than a professional opinion the best route to go?
Absolutely. And also, I've been in financial services since I left college in too many years ago. I was a trader in the city. I left Deutsche Bank a while back. I was an equity trader, which of course has quite a relevance for pensions, because the backbone of every bit of pension advice is the funds that the money is going into. Whilst I can't or wouldn't even dare to question whether the constituents of a particular fund are good or not, I'm certainly in a position to, I have views on world markets, growing economies. And I think I can perhaps explain it in a way that the client would appreciate, that how to fit the right funds to the right level of risk, which again, I think is something that is perhaps glossed over too quickly by some financial advisors.
Okay, and just to confirm regarding this podcast, nothing we talk about in this podcast is advice we're just hypothetically talking about what you do as an expert and how that fits into the jigsaw, I'm going to call it.
Absolutely. Hopefully I'm a bit more than one piece of the jigsaw, but yeah.
Okay, good. The reason why we've ended up with pensions, everyone, is that back in 2012, we entered into the world in the UK and how for auto-enrollment. So a certain percentage of your salary goes into a pot, which is run normally by a pension fund, but it's been set up by your employer. And the employer is putting a little bit in and you're putting a little bit in unless you've opted out. And so the idea is that over time, your pot will grow. However, talking that through, what many people don't know or realize, and I certainly didn't until very recently talking to Wayne, is you have options. And that's where we want to dig in slightly here. So Wayne, what are we talking about here?
Well, so if I can just give you a little bit of a background. I mean, I don't think anyone would ever accuse me of sitting on the fence. And this is what I believe. I'm sure if someone at the FCA actually thought I was suggesting that auto-enrollment is little better than the paper it's printed on, I'd probably get shut. But I really do believe that. The problem with auto-enrollment is it allows an employee to believe they have a private pension to provide for their future, which they do, but it's not going to provide for your future. The numbers are so low. 8%, even over 35, 40 years, is not going to provide for your future pension. The problem is that for big companies such as Vodafone, HSBC, they are not going to redirect any number of individuals' pension payments elsewhere. So this is really for SME employers who care about their employees. Enrollment is a commoditized pension where it's driven by low costs from the main providers like Now, People's Pension, and it's basically a tick box exercise for a small employer and the employee. The option is they opt out, and those pension contributions are redirected to a private pension fund with a financial advisor such as ourselves. So the money will end up still, we manage the money, we don't manage the funds. The funds will end up with the same main BlackRock, Fidelity, the same providers, but into a fund that is deemed to be fit for the individual, not just every employee of a 200,000 employee company. And also by doing this, the mechanism is in place that should the employee or the employer want to make further contributions, they can, because the private pension is in place.
So can you pretend I'm 7 years old for a moment, Wayne? Yeah. So my understanding at the moment and from my own experience is that the employer puts a percentage into a pot and the employee does. Are you saying that one of the options potentially for a listener to do is to opt out of that, and does the employer put the money into a separate scheme, or how does that work?
One would expect you still to continue. There is no, obviously, if you opt out, there's no commitment on what the employer or the employee does, but the right thing to do, obviously, would be that the same contributions that were going to the auto-enrollment pot are now going to the new private pension for that employee. So one would hope the employer would still put 5% in, and the employee would be putting at least his 3% in. And as I said, bonuses, or the employee can put further contributions and get tax relief up to £60,000 a year.
So, and again, pretending I'm a seven-year-old, what you're saying is that the providers who are mainly providing the service to most SMEs in the UK, to them, because of the low income per client, I'm going to say, although they obviously do their very best within the resources they have, it may be better that actually if you went to more of a bespoke solution, they might be able to twist some knobs and all the rest of it and perhaps get your money working a bit harder.
Absolutely. I mean, nobody tries to do a bad job, obviously. They all try and do the best they can, but I truly believe that they are driven by getting everything in under a certain cost. So when the employer is looking for a new, let's say, auto enrollment provider for 100,000 employees, it's the cost of managing that auto enrollment scheme that is a prime determinant, not how well it's done in the past.
Understand that.
I can't help feeling that, one, you do get what you pay for, and two, there's perhaps things where if you're going to try and cut costs, your future maybe isn't it.
So I can imagine, you know, someone who, say, employs 10 people even, you know, if everyone came up to them saying, okay, well, I've decided to put my pension into this amount of money, can you as an employer please make a separate payment every single month? You know, you're adding administrative burden to the employer, to be fair.
Yeah.
So are there other options if my employer won't do that, I can go down?
As an individual, you can, of course, well, not of course, you're allowed to have more than one pension a year. So in any tax year, just because you've got auto-enrollment pension doesn't mean that you can't ask me to introduce you to the right pension provider for you, which you can then make contributions to your own private pension. That is another path. And then should you leave your job with the inflexible private pension scheme, you can then transfer that auto-enrollment pension to the pension with us or with anyone else. And it's not left in limbo until you suddenly hit 57 and they're asking you what you want to do about your pension.
Okay. So what we're saying there is that if your employer can't facilitate paying, if they're kind enough to do the employer contributions into different pension providers, I'm going to call it, then the other route is that the employer does whatever the requirement is at that time, and the employee also does, but the employee wants to add more, so perhaps instead of paying it into the company pension scheme, they put that into a private, and then perhaps every year you say, actually, let's transfer the money I've collected from my employer scheme into my private scheme, so it's in that sort of pot. Is that what we're saying?
Absolutely. I think one of the problems, not problems, is that when you're in your 20s and 30s and you're changing jobs, I don't think there's much of an awareness of how important a pension is. So, you know, it's just non-contributory pension and you think, yes, that's a tick box. People don't really think in their 30s, well, you know, how much is going into it? Is it with a decent provider? I mean, I know when I had jobs in the city, one of them had what, with hindsight, proved to be one of the best pension schemes in England. It was a defined benefit, which is a final salary scheme, and it was with 137.5, which I know is an odd number, for every year you worked. So to get your maximum 2/3 final salary pension, which was the most allowed at the time, you had to work 25 years. For a lot of places, it was 60, so you'd have to work 40 years to get your 2/3. And I think for some places now, it's out to 120. So you cannot get your 2/3 because you can't accumulate enough service years. And that's what we're trying to perhaps help prevent, the fact that the benevolent pension schemes provided by good employers in the past, which have now, because of the costs, almost basically gone into a black hole. I think it's very important that people realise that the government is not going to look after you in your old age. State pension with 35 years national insurance is about £12,000 a year and change. If you think about your utility bills, insurance, maybe you want Sky TV, £1,000 a month is not going to go very far, which is why it's so important, I think, that people address their future lives, their pension requirements.
Okay, so question I imagine most people have got in their mind listening to this is that, is there any independent documents, which says what the difference is? I know markets go up and down, and this podcast isn't about advice, but, you know, is there a difference between putting money into, I'm going to say, mainstream bulk pensions, if that's the right way of putting it, versus ones which may have higher management fees because of extra eye on it, in my language? Is there any stats on that, money in the party?
Not that I know of. I'm sure there are, but of course, there's two things that affect, well, three things that affect your future returns. One is how long you've got your money in the market. So that doesn't change. The other two facts are one is the cost of managing that pension fund to the end user, and the other is the performance. So hopefully I'm not stating the obvious here, but if the performance is good, but the charges are high, no point being in that fund. You need to find the best balance between performance and costs. And it cannot be overemphasized that if there was some sort of nirvana we could get to where we'd better recommend a fund that is costing the user 0.1% a year, yet every single year it returns 10%, it would be fantastic. But living in an ideal world, and that fund doesn't exist. So costs and performance are two very important figures here.
So, Wayne, so different pots will perform in different ways. The performance, yes, you can look historically at different pots to hopefully get a feel, but who knows what's going to happen in the marketplace and what triggers those things. But so irrespective, if you've got your own private pension and you're putting the money from your employer into it, then you have more control. But what would be good practice? How often should the average person review where their pension is, and how should you review it? I'm going to say,
I have told clients who've been put into pensions and they've got an app, do not look at it every day because you will go mad. You won't be able to see the wood for the trees. It's having been a trader, I know this so much. If you have a goal, it's very easy to get distracted by the short-term static. I would suggest at least once a year. I mean, the danger is even with that, you're going to end up changing pension funds every year if you think that the one you're in is not doing too well. And the psychology of this is huge, of course, because perhaps the argument is that the fund, should you be a fund because you were very you're very vocal that you need to be in let's say South American equities against all of the point out, it's very high risk, and South American equities haven't done as well as you expected, so it's time to review. But do you leave a fund that's done badly, or do you think, well, I've had the pain, I've been in the fund that hasn't performed, I don't want to be the person to get out at the bottom when it suddenly turns around? So you're now kind of very much in a kind of almost impossible quandary, you know, whether you do or you don't, psychologically, it's going to be the wrong decision. So I would think that all the time the fund is a complete disaster and you're happy with the reviews and the information you're getting from your financial advisor, unless you have a fundamental shift in finances or your risk, stick with what you've got. And this is also perhaps, if you don't mind me kind of make a slight detour, Andrew, pension pot consolidation. So what happens very often is, let's say someone was an employee of X, Y, or Z in their 20s and 30s, they've changed jobs, they've left their pension pots from those previous employers behind. What will happen is you then become an account number to the pension provider, whether it's it doesn't matter whether it's one of the Aviva funds or BlackRock, it doesn't matter. You become an account number, so they really have, well, they don't have meetings with you because you as an individual are not a client of, let's say, Aviva. Aviva only know the details they had from you when you joined the original scheme and when you've left. And what a lot of firms do is that they have effectively that, I can't remember what the term it is, well, it's not lifestyle pensions, but they take the view that everyone in their 20s and 30s has X appetite for risk because you've got time for it to come right. So you have more appetite for risk in your 20s to 30s than you do in your 30s to 40s. So what they will automatically do is everyone who has a pension account with them in their 20s to 30s will be in a higher risk funds than when they hit 30. So when you hit 30, they start to de-risk you a little bit. And then when you hit 40, for that next decade, they automatically de-risk you even more, i.e. they move you away from, I'm not going to say exciting, the riskier but high-risk, high-reward markets. And by the time you're 50, that you'll be in cash or gilt. Now, that may not be where you want to be. You know, at 50, you might want to still work for another 25 years. But the pension fund that you join when you're in your 20s, they don't know that. So you're automatically, your pension fund is de-risked by putting it into cash and gilts, which is not where people always want to be. So by consolidating your pensions, you have a regular review of your funds, who you are, where you want to be, and your retirement goals.
Okay. So for myself, listening into this podcast and learning here, what we're saying is that we don't need to keep our money in with the scheme which the employer has picked for us. We can transfer the money out. If we've got a very accommodating employer, then we may be able to, they may be prepared to pay their percentage into a private fund rather than I'm going to say the company chosen fund. It's worthwhile digging out all the different pots you may have and considering, should you bring it into one or should you not? And that's where you definitely need an advisor, I would assume. And taking all that into account, don't look at it daily because you'll get yourself a headache.
You'll come back.
But certainly have a look at it every year to see, are you tracking in the right sort of direction? And if you're not, to ask questions.
100%. I mean, with a good financial advisor, I would think any financial advisor, you'll have at least a yearly review meeting, which you won't have as a employee of a pension scheme. And I think the yearly meetings are important to ensure that you get that you are where you need to be, that you're heading towards your goals, which would be a big discussion between you, the individual, and the financial advisor.
Sure. But we're sitting here having a conversation where at this moment in what you offer, you're not a pension, sorry, a financial advisor. You're an introducer. But the advantage to a listener to working with someone like yourself is because of the significant experience you've had in your career, what you're constantly looking at is the performance of the advisors which you're working with and how they're looking after many clients which you have introduced and looked, and also because you your job is to keep your ears and eyes open and to challenge. Although you're not advising, you'll introduce people who will advise and then translate where required.
Absolutely. I think I also, one thing I come across quite a lot is the ease of admin. And it doesn't sound like a big thing, but trust me, if you're getting asked from 15 different emails and calls every other day that we need this, we need that, admin is enough to, well, grind most people down. So as soon as I feel that, if I felt the admin is outweighing advance, you're being with financial advisor X, Y, or Z, then I would actually move on. And the other thing is that even though the individual doesn't pay me, I get paid by the financial advisor, there's no increased cost to the end user. And also, effectively, they are becoming part of a much bigger client base, which is me introducing them rather than just going along and they're just another number. So I would like to think that the sheer number of people I introduce to the right financial advisor gives me some kind of, not clout, but weight of clients to actually make sure that they are treated properly.
Absolutely. So you're just not a solo. You're part of a group with someone with your back, for want of a better word.
Absolutely. And it's a conversation I have with the financial advisors, para planners and admin, an awful lot when they ask me, should they chase someone? I hate to use the word chase, but not everybody gets all the information together one time. And it's something that I make the judgment on whether I think we're beginning to hound on, please just let them get on with it. And I think it's something that's often overlooked. So that's, I ease the burden of information also.
Okay. So time for a shameless plug. So if you haven't retired yet, and you're putting whatever the amount is, if it's a tiny amount or a significant amount, and you just want someone who isn't an advisor just to have a chat with, and just to have a conversation in English, then they should reach out to you. Is that correct, Ray?
Absolutely. As I said earlier, I think perhaps my main skill is translating what a financial advisor sees as everyday language to reducing it in front of them to the client, so there's no confusion what the client actually, what that means to the client, what they can expect. And I'd like to think that I ensure that I help the client get what they actually do need from a financial advisor.
Sure.
Okay. And I do know coffee shops, literally the best coffee shop in any given town in the south of England.
Brilliant. I mean, you say the south of England, but I mean, will you assist people anywhere in the UK?
Yes, Andrew. I mean, if I may not be able to get to the best coffee shop in a particular town, Zoom is always an option. There are minimum pension pots that, unfortunately, it doesn't really make it worthwhile us looking at. I'm more than happy to have a meeting anyway on Zoom or in real life. There's no charge. There's no charge for me, no charge for my time. If I can't help the individual, I'll hopefully at least they will leave, whether a Zoom or a real life meeting, with a little bit more information. I'll hopefully I'll better guide them what their next steps are, even if it's not with me.
Okay, so if you would like to reach out to Wayne, his details will be shown on whatever platform you're listening or watching this on. Meanwhile, just as a quick reminder, this has been brought to you by the Academy World. And as I said earlier, our role is to support SMEs in the United Kingdom with whatever needs you may have and pairing you up with the skills or the systems which you need. So meanwhile, Wayne, thank you so much for your time today. Very much appreciated.
Thank you, Andrew.
And next week we'll have another expert on hand who hopefully will be fulfilling you with loads of knowledge. Meanwhile, have a great week. Take care now. Bye-bye.
This podcast is for discussion purposes only and does not constitute financial, investment or pension advice. Neither Andrew Kirkley of the Academy World nor Wayne Grossman are regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority, FCA, and we do not recommend or endorse any specific financial products, services or providers. Listeners should seek independent financial advice from a qualified professional before making any decisions related to pensions, investments, or other financial matters. Past performance is not indicative of future results, and all investments carry risk.